Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for June 1st, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Wasn't quite sure I was going to be here today, so I had to rush to put this together. I hope it doesn't sound that way. I got a couple of guests lined up. In about 10 minutes, we'll hear from Ervand Abrahamian. I hope I'm not brutalizing his name too badly. Professor of history at Baruch College, City University of New York, talking about what the Bush administration offer to talk with Iran, what that means. And also, what is going on within Iran? What's going on with the regime there, and politics of the mullahs and resistance to the mullahs, and what that all means. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be speaking with Michelle Goldberg, who is the author of the book. I'm forgetting the title, but about the Christian right and Christian nationalism. And I will, of course, inform myself before she arrives. We will talk to her about what they have up their sleeves, who they are, what their institutions are, what their ambitions are, and how we can fight them, presuming that most of you do want to fight them. And before we get to our first interview, review of the headlines, first of all, this morning the Department of Labor reporting that jobless claims, that is people who have lost their jobs, and signed up for the first time for unemployment benefits. That was up 7,000 last week to 336,000, kind of on the high side, above expectations. And that number has been creeping upwards. It was distorted for a few weeks by the government shutdown in Puerto Rico. But now that is passed, and it does seem that the fundamental trend is creeping upwards. What that means suggests that, it suggests that the job market, while still in reasonably decent shape, does seem to be softening a little bit. And tomorrow morning, at 8:30, we will get the Bureau of Labor Statistics monthly report on employment and unemployment, looking for about 150,000 new jobs created in the month of May, which was a pretty good number, but not a great number. We shall see. Very close attention paid to the earnings components of the employment report tomorrow. Some people worried that the job market is, although it doesn't feel too good for most people, there do seem to be some shortages of certain kind of skilled workers. Employers constantly complaining about that, and that means that they have to bid up wages, which is something employers never like to do, and they always whine about that. So the Federal Reserve and Wall Street, some signs of concern about rising wage pressures, which means rising inflation, and a crimp on profits, which, of course, is never welcome on Wall Street or at the Federal Reserve. And minutes from the Federal Reserve's policymaking meeting from May 10th, released yesterday, a lot of conversation, apparently. Although these are often very sanitized minutes, we won't know what really happened until the full transcripts are released in 5 years. There's a lot of anxiety about inflation expressed, high oil prices, high commodity prices. Copper and other metals just been zooming for the past few months. Some of that is the result of speculation by professional speculators, hedge funds, and investment banks and the like. But some of it the function of real industrial demand because of rapid growth in China particularly. So some concern that as the labor market tightens, wages are creeping up, and also commodity prices are creeping up, inflationary threat. This will be a topic of very close attention in the coming weeks. Is this just a blip, or is this something for real? The Federal Reserve and Wall Street not wanting to relive the 1970s when inflation kept rising and rising and rising until it reached, in the double digits during the Jimmy Carter years. That was undone by Paul Volcker and Ronald Reagan the crackdown on the working class, the class war from above, very, very successful class war from above. They feel like they won that one and don't want to give any ground. So we shall see what emerges in the coming weeks. The ABC News Washington Post Weekly Survey of Consumer Attitudes, taking a big slide in the last several weeks, up a couple of points yesterday in yesterday's release, but a very sharp decline from early April into late May, the result. primarily, it's presumed, of rising gasoline prices, but also some sense that maybe the job market is deteriorating. The Bush administration always complaining that they're not getting credit for the good economy, and one of the reasons for that is that for an awful lot of people, it hasn't been such a great economy. Wages have been stagnant. Jobs have been not as plentiful as they were in the 1990s, it's been great if you're a CEO or a stockholder, but if you're someone else, not so great. And that's why the Bush administration hasn't been getting credit for what they perceive as a good economy. What Bush once described as his constituency, the haves and have-mores, they're doing great. The have-not-so-much is not doing so well. And showing up more and more, not only in the political polls, but the economic surveys as well. But people still spending money. Chain stores, it was reported, having a good month in May, year-to-year growth of 4%, down a bit from April's close to 7%, but still well above expectations. The April number boosted by the fact that Easter occurred in April this year and March the previous year. So good year-to-year comparisons in April. So that was somewhat artificially inflated. But people are spending money. They're borrowing money and spending it because there's not a lot of income growth, but there certainly is a lot of debt growth. But the housing market, which has been one of the prime driving forces of the U.S. economy in the last years, still showing signs of cooling. It does seem that the great housing bubble is leaking, and now we're having to contend, or we will have to contend, with what follows that, one of the great speculative bubbles in the history of real estate. But the Mortgage Bankers Association reporting a decline in mortgage demand last week, second consecutive week, and it's been declining most weeks for the last year or so. So it does look like the housing market is slowing down, people borrowing less to buy new houses, borrowing less against the appreciated value of their house and spending the proceeds. It does look like that market is cooling, and we do have to figure what that all means. If job growth is slowing and the housing market is slowing and the Federal Reserve is pushing up interest rates, then the economy may be slowing rather substantially and with very high debt burdens on many households. Will that result in crunching sounds as the economy slows down? Will we the self-propelling cycle of borrowing and spending turn into the reverse of foreclosure and retrenchment? That will be the big story economically in the coming months. And then finally, a new nominee for Secretary of the Treasury, President Bush the other day nominating Hank Paulson, who has been the head of Goldman Sachs. This appointment interesting on several counts. He is almost certain to be confirmed, so he will be the first substantial person to hold the job in this administration. His predecessors, Paul O'Neill and John Snow, were both industrialists. O'Neill out of Alcoa, the aluminum firm, and John Snow from CSX, the railroad, both industrialists, which is kind of odd in an office that's often, though not exclusively, reserved for Wall Street types. Both O'Neill and Snow were unimpressive intellectually and politically. They were never taken very seriously, either inside the administration or outside. O'Neill did make a splash for dissing the Bushies after he left office, and Snow has had to endure the indignity of repeated leaks of his imminent departure that started just after the 2004 election. Now, a year and a half later, he's finally going. Part of the reason it took so long to replace him was that it was hard to find somebody who wanted to take the job, which had, until now, has been seen mainly as a salesman for administration policies decided upon by the inner circle and heavyweights who are likely to be the sort who would become the Treasury Secretary want to make policy, not sell it. It's not likely that Hank Paulson would have taken the job if he was merely intended to shake the pom-poms. So this is further evidence that Bush's low poll numbers now are forcing him to be a little less arrogant and a little more solicitous of the old establishment. As head of Goldman Sachs, Paulson ran what is probably the most prestigious and most powerful investment house on Wall Street. Actually, it's just off Wall Street at 45 Broad, no name on the building, but that's where they are. Goldman Sachs is a major money machine. Compensation per employee averaged almost $500,000 last year, although that was hardly distributed equally. They made profits of about $250,000 per employee. The top managing directors there pull in about $20 to $30 million a year. Lower level ones, $2 to $3 million a year. Successful traders get bonuses in the $20 million range. Paulson himself took in about $38 million last year, and he's said to be worth, in monetary terms, about $700 million. So he's taking a big pay cut to become Treasury Secretary, where the salary is a mere $183,500 a year. Will he be? What about policy? What's the policy implication? It looks like his thinking is pretty much in line with the Bush administration. He supported the tax cuts and helped push the firm, which was once pretty heavily Democratic, at least in its contributions. Think of Robert Rubin and John Corzine, former co-chairs. Paulson helped push Goldman into the Republican camp. He's not very much worried about our trade deficit, doesn't seem too worried about the budget deficit. But he is, as the Financial Times put it yesterday, a bit of a tree hugger. He is the chairman of the Nature Conservancy, supporter of the Kyoto Protocol, and whether he has any success in selling these positions to the gang of oil men around Bush and Cheney seems unlikely, but we will see. One possible reason for the appointment could be that there's some anxiety circulating that foreigners will stop pouring so much money into the United States, the $2 to $3 billion a day habit that has allowed us as a nation to live way beyond our means. That can't go on forever, but no one knows what it's going to look like when it stops. But perhaps the hope is that Paulson will reassure foreign investors, or at least be a skilled hand in managing any financial crisis. Let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back with Ervind Abrahamian.
Buy it, use it, break it, fix it, trash it, change it, mail, upgrade it, charge it, point it, zoom it, press it, snap it, work it, quick erase it, write it, cut it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, quick rewrite it, plug it, play it, burn it, rip it, drag it, drop it, zip, unzip it, lock it, fill it, curl it, find it, view it, code it, jump, unlock it, surf it, scroll it, pose it, click it, cross it, crack it, twitch, update it, name it, read it, tune it, print it, scan it, send it, fax, rename it, touch it, bring it, pay it, watch it, turn it, leave it, start format. At it. Buy it, use it, break it, fix it, trash it, change it, mail, upgrade it, charge it, point it, zoom it, press it, snap it, work it, quick erase it, write it, cut it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, quick rewrite it, plug it, play it, burn it, rip it, drag it, drop it, zip, unzip it, lock it, fill it, curl it, find it, view it, code it, jump, unlock it, surf it, scroll it, pose it, click it, cross it, crack it, twitch, update it, name it, read it, tune it, print it, scan it, send it, fax, rename it, touch it, ring it, pay it, watch it, turn it, leave it, stock on. Technologic.
And that a little bit from Daft Punk's Technologic, I think a single that came out last year. And now we're joined on the line by Ervind Abrahamian, who is a professor of history at Baruch College at the City University of New York and an expert on Iran. Welcome to WBAI.
Hi.
I hope I'm not mangling your name too badly.
No, it's right.
Okay, so first of all, the Bush administration taking what looks like making a big change in agreeing to talk to Iran. What's the story behind the headlines?
Well, the big change that is being clouded is that, you know, before U.S. had refused to talk to Iran, even though Iran had made some steps to talk to United States. And the new position of U.S. is that it's willing to negotiate with Iran. I think this is more basically to appease the Europeans, because the Europeans have been pushing the United States to negotiate directly with Iran rather than Europeans being intermediaries. The problem is Rice put this condition on negotiations with Iran, which is that Iran has to suspend the nuclear enrichment program. And that's really a non-starter. The only way the problem could be solved is if the word suspension means only temporary suspension, in which case the Iranians might accept that. But starting off by saying Iran has to suspend its program is, for the Iranians, it's been always not a position to start from.
Well, is that the point of the condition? Are they trying, as the New York Times asked the question today, are they setting these talks up to fail, but didn't really answer the question? Do you think that's what's going on?
Well, it could be that, or it could be they're hoping they'll finesse the issue of suspension and the Iranians will temporarily stop it on the standing. It's just a temporary suspension until something more is offered. But there is a problem with that. There are two problems with that, which is Iran suspended its program actually for 3 years while they negotiated, hoping that there would be some serious offer from the U.S. side. And that offer never really came, so they then ended their suspension. The second problem is, as far as I can understand about nuclear technology, with these enrichment, it's hard to restart once you suspend it. It actually can cause damage with the material. So I think the scientists themselves might be reluctant to stop it.
Now, what's your opinion? Iran says it's just pursuing civilian nuclear technology. Most people think that they want a nuclear bomb. What do you think?
I think what they want is actually the option of being able to make a bomb if they ever need to in the distant future. If they're ever in a war situation like they were with the Iraqis, then if it would be useful for them to have the option of being able to make a bomb, which means they would have the scientific knowledge, the material, the equipment, but they wouldn't actually assemble a bomb in normal circumstances. And this is known as the Japanese option, and a number of other countries besides Japan have it. It's just they have the ability of having a bomb, but they don't actually exercise that ability in normal situation. I think this would make sense for Iran to have the same policy, which means that when they say they don't have a plan to make a bomb, I think they're being honest about that. But, of course, from the U.S. side, the fear is that if Iran has that option, then it might exercise that option at some point. And the U.S. position is that that's intolerable. And that's where the real nitty-gritty comes in, because if the only way U.S. can be reassured that Iran doesn't have the option is Iran doesn't have any nuclear enrichment program whatsoever, which is then a non-starter for Iran.
And, of course, Israel has anywhere from 100 to 400 nuclear weapons, although they would admit to that, but that's certainly the case. So why should Iran not have a nuclear weapon?
There is no real, you know, moral issue about it, I don't think. I think you could argue that it has the right since other countries have it, but I don't think that's a line of argument that really anyone wants to use, because it's not something that it's an argument every country can have. Then you would have basically every country in the world saying we have a right to have it because some other country has it. And the Iranian position has been always that it doesn't actually want to have the bomb. It's not in its interest to have a bomb.
I'm speaking with Ervand Abrahamian, who is a professor of history at Baruch College at the City University of New York and an expert on Iran. How does this nuclear saber-rattling play into Iranian domestic politics? Is that part of the consideration?
Well, it's been presented within the Iranian context as a civilian, a non-weapon program, that nuclear technology is something that any basically self-respecting country should have, has the right to have it. And so as a peaceful nuclear project, it's very much now tied into issue of national prestige, national honor, and that the Europeans and the Americans are trying to prevent Iran from basically having its birthright to have its scientific technology. It's been presented basically that the cutting edge of modern science is nuclear science. Iran wants to be basically, a developed industrial country. To do that, it needs nuclear technology, and anyone who tries to prevent Iran doing that is actually trying to keep Iran underdeveloped, a poor country. And this fits into a whole historical cycle of imperial powers trying to keep Iran underdeveloped. And that's the way it's presented to the public. And I think the public very much accepts it that way. across the whole spectrum, I would say, left or right or center. It's seen as it's basically a national prestige issue to have a nuclear enrichment program, with the qualification that it's not necessarily for military purposes.
And let's talk a bit about the Ahmadinejad. How do you pronounce his name?
Yes, Ahmadinejad.
Let's talk about his regime for a bit. I mean, he talks on one side of his mouth like a modernizer. He's like, allows women into sports stadiums now, somewhat loosening up the rule of the mullahs, although some analysts say he is essentially a creature of the mullahs, and that he's just loosening up a bit to firm up their long-term rule. He also talks often like an economic populist. He was elected as a champion of the poor, talks some about redistribution. Is he some kind of Persian Hugo Chavez, or how do you read his politics?
Well, one thing to keep in mind, he is not actually running either the country or the foreign policy. The president in Iran is not basically the top dog. The supreme leader and the National Security Council makes decisions on foreign policy. So the nuclear issue is not under his guidance. What he can do is he has the bully pulpit in a way. He can talk publicly, raise issues, cause problems even for other people in the elite. And his road to success has been very much, as you said, a populist appeal that he talked about basically justice, economic benefits to the poor, that the revolution had not helped the poor, that he himself comes from a very poor background, that he lives in a very modest style. And he talks like the simple man. He is very blunt. You can say a straightforward guy.
But he also has a doctorate in engineering, right? He's not a total rube.
Yeah, no, I mean, again, like our own populist president from Texas, the substance is not necessarily the image. He has obviously benefited a great deal from university education. But he does, I mean, there is some truth in that he does come from the lower classes, and his father was a blacksmith, in fact, and it was through scholarship and the revolution that he obtained a university education. And he does talk basically the language of the common man, and I think the real strength of his election was the fact that he lived like a simple person. He didn't live like much of the elite in Iran. So the populist factor is important. The question is how much of that populist promises he can meet. It's one thing to say that he's going to attack the wealth of the rich. But nothing actually has been done. And, of course, in the revolution, the bazaar, which is the economic merchant class, was very much in favor of the revolution and is very much at the back of the Islamic Republic. So it's one thing to talk about redistribution of income, but it's another thing to do actually anything substantial, because that would create tensions within the regime. So far, all he's done is talk about actually giving money to newlywed couples, that may, you know, win some friends, but it really does not bring about a social program, social change.
Well, with oil over $70 a barrel, they must be pulling in buckets of money. So where's all that money go?
Well, part of it is being put aside for a sort of like an emergency war chest in case actually there is a major crisis with the U.S. Some of it is being, and even before the oil boom, a considerable amount of money was going into rural programs. So the regime has actually done quite a lot since 1990 in, you know, bringing electricity, water, clean water, schools, medical facilities to the rural sectors of the society. And that has done quite a lot to strengthen the regime.
What about that regime? They've been around for over 25 years. It's hardly a revolutionary regime anymore. There's all this talk of how Iran has a very young population who's very sick of rule by the mullahs. A few years ago, it looked like they were looking a little rickety, but now they don't seem quite so rickety. What's going on with the mullahs' rule?
Well, the presumption was, of course, that the young people will all be Western, pro-West, liberal, reformist, sort of supporters of the Khatami and the previous president. What that discounted was the class factor. I think for the upper, the middle class, upper middle class, the youth there, yes, I think very much gravitates towards a liberal democracy. But what the last presidential election showed also is that youth from the poor areas, the urban masses, have grievances, economic grievances, and those were really channeled into supporting Ahmadinejad, which is, by no stretch of the imagination, liberal democracy.
Okay, and then so what's we have to do that debased journalistic thing and do a little crystal ball gazing. What's your view? As is the United States going to end up bombing Iran? Will we come to some kind of accommodation?
Well, the way it is now, it's really irreconcilable interest. U.S. is adamant that Iran should not have the nuclear enrichment cycle, and Iran's position is this is its birthright; it has to have it. I can't see the Iranian regime actually backing down. I don't think they can back it down. They've basically hit so much of their prestige on that. It's not a one-party state like Gaddafi in Libya, where the leader can change direction suddenly. In Iran, it's a much more complicated situation. And I don't think the elite is in a position to be able to do that. So the only way I think there could be any peaceful resolution is if the U.S. actually backed down and was willing to accept enrichment on the understanding the enrichment would not develop into a weapons program. And so far, there's no indication that the U.S. is willing to do that. And, of course, the elephant in the room is in this situation very much Israel. Israel is the party that is most concerned about Iran having the nuclear option. Frankly, of course, a nuclear option really would not be a threat to the United States, but Israel sees it as a threat to itself, and that brings in Israel to the whole complicated situation.
And do you think Israel would act on its own and bomb Iranian nuclear facilities, or would they, the United States, restrain them from doing that, or encourage them to do that?
Well, I there are two problems with Israel doing it. One is a logistical problem. They would have to go through airspace that United States controls, ironically through Iraq. So if they do that, Iranians would blame United States. And for Iran, really, it wouldn't make much difference whether the airstrikes came from the U.S. or Israel. They would retaliate against United States. So the people who would pay for that would be the U.S. in Iraq rather than Israel. So that would actually give the United States a good interest to restrain Israel from attacking.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
I've been speaking with Ervan Abrahamian, who is a professor of history and an expert in Iran, who teaches at Baruch College here at the City University of New York. Let's take a little break, and I will be back with Michelle Goldberg.
The National Board of the Pacifica Foundation, which sets policy for WBAI and four other radio stations, will hold its quarterly public meeting on Friday, June 2nd from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., Saturday, June 3rd from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., and Sunday, June 4th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. The meeting will be held at the Marriott East Side, located at 525 Lexington Avenue between 48th and 49th Streets in Manhattan. The location is wheelchair accessible and public comment is welcome each day. For details, go to www.wbai.org/lsb or call 212-209-2919. That's 212-209-2919. The proceedings will be web streamed live at kpftx.org.
And Death, all to power pop. That's a bit of Narina Pellot. I don't know. She's English. I don't know whether she pronounces it in the English style or in the French style. But that's Everybody's Gone to War. If God is Our Side, God is a Joker. I think a new single just released in Britain a week or two ago. And now we're joined in the studio by, I should say, this is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, WBAI, New York 99.5 FM, and on the web at WBAI.org. And thanks to those of you who pledged during our recent pledge drive. And if you pledged, please make good. And even if you didn't pledge, send in a check. We need it. Or visit the website and pledge there. It's ready to take your money 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, even on holidays. Okay, so now we're joined in the studio by Michelle Goldberg, who is a writer for Salon and author of the book Kingdom Coming, a book about Christian nationalism just published by W.W. Norton. Welcome to WBAI and Behind the News, Michelle.
Oh, thank you for having me.
First, tell us about Generation Joshua. Who is Generation Joshua?
Sure, Generation Joshua. Well, the theme behind my book is that Christian nationalism is this movement to turn America into an explicitly Christian nation where the Bible is authoritative. And so a lot of the leaders of the movement feel like the way to do that is not necessarily to keep petitioning the Republican Party that they feel like keeps betraying them, but to become the Republican Party and to remake the government from within. And so there's a homeschool a college for homeschooled students who've been kind of raised in this ideology, you know, from a very young age, called Patrick Henry, that aims to channel these kids into, you know, different parts of the administration and, you know, the Congress and basically the power structure.
And you're doing a pretty good job of it.
Right, yeah. Patrick Henry College actually provides and one year it provided more White House interns than any other school, which is remarkable given that Patrick Henry total has less than 300 students, you know, and yet it's competing with schools like Georgetown and the Ivy Leagues, you know, because these are competitive positions. But anyway, the idea behind Generation Joshua is to basically involve homeschooled kids in politics even before they get to Patrick Henry. I mean, even before they're old enough to vote. And so it was started by Michael Ferris, the founder of Patrick Henry College. And the idea is that there's, you know, somewhere between 1 and 2 million kids being homeschooled in America. Most of them, although not all, are being homeschooled for religious reasons. So they're overwhelmingly evangelical Christians. And the idea behind Generation Joshua is that all public policy needs to be determined by a literal reading of the Bible. And they have what they call a Christian worldview. And they say that if you have the right Christian worldview, you can determine the Christian answer to any question, which expands beyond things like homosexuality or gay marriage or abortion or anything. You know, they'll tell you there's like the biblical answer to what the tax rate should be. which is a flat tax of 15%. But and so Generation Joshua, they have this guy Ned Ryan runs it, who's actually a former Bush speechwriter. And the idea is two things. First, to teach these kids how to derive their political ideology from the Bible and then translate it into secular language so that they can make arguments that sound as if they're reasoned when debating people who aren't part of this movement. And then also to send them out to work for conservative Republican politicians. So in 2004, which is the first year Generation Joshua was really active, they sent teams of homeschool students, all expenses paid, to work on Bush's reelection campaign in swing states, as well as the election campaign of the most right-wing Republican senators, like Tom Coburn, Jim DeMint, you know, and these were people who were elected, you know, who kind of pushed an already right-wing Congress much further to the right.
Now, where do these people come from? If you, I read several of Richard Hofstadter's books recently for my own purposes, and written in the 50s and 60s, and he was pretty convinced that that kind of religious conservative worldview was receding, and that their best days were behind them. And then I remember the mid-1970s, when I was in college, and my roommate came upstairs and said, the God Squad is down in the common room. There are four guys in a campus crusade singing Christian songs, and believe me, that was not a common sight of the Yale campus in 1973 or 1974. And then when I got to graduate school in the University of Virginia, late 70s, my friends and I used to watch some of the religious programming with great amusement. It was very entertaining. We'd watched Jim, what my friend called Jim 2K Baker, and Tammy Faye, and we all thought it was really funny. But it seemed kind of marginal and weird in the 70s. And then by the 80s, obviously, it was no longer marginal. It was very weird, but no longer very marginal. So how did they stage this incredible revival? They're given up for dead by urban intellectuals in the 50s and 60s, and now they're in the White House.
Well, they've been being given up for dead by urban intellectuals since the 20s. I mean, you know, after the Scopes trial, there was a kind of widespread assumption that they had been so humiliated that they would just kind of slink off and eventually give up these, you know, ridiculous beliefs. They did slink off, but they didn't give up their beliefs. They just kind of built this very powerful parallel infrastructure, you know, which kind of nurtured this, you know, this movement when they were ready to kind of make their assault on the mainstream. I mean, I think it's really telling. When we talk about Generation Joshua, they call it Generation Joshua for a reason. It has this very specific biblical meaning. Moses led his people out of exile, but never made it to the promised land. So he led his people out of the kind of out of Egypt, you know, out of oppression, but into the wilderness. But the idea was always to use that time to stage a kind of assault on Israel. So the idea is that the Moses generation, as Michael Ferris calls them, kind of led people out of the kind of godless, secular public culture so that they could build their own culture. And the Joshua generation is supposed to lead the assault to retake it because they see it as rightfully theirs. So part of it is just that this institution building has been happening pretty continuously, and especially in the last 20 years has, you know, it's just an incredibly rich network, you know, with just libraries full of books and an entire parallel history and really a whole parallel reality. And then, you know, and then there's a kind of deeper question, which is why this fundamentalist upsurge all over the world? And, you know, that's a question I wish I could answer. I think it obviously, you know, has something to do with people's kind of despair and feeling out of control and old ideologies not being available to give anyone a kind of all-encompassing answer to what they're here for and how history is progressing. But, I mean, it's just the organization. Part of the thing that's interesting is that you see someone, you know, Tammy Faye Baker was a good example, although, you know, that was years ago. The public faced this movement, as far as secular people are concerned, has often seemed so ridiculous that it seemed as if it didn't have to be taken seriously. Whereas there was actually a lot of thought and very sophisticated movement building going on. And so now you have, you know, for example, one of the things I write about in the book is that they've established all of these parallel, for instance, scientific organizations, you know, so that they have their own quasi-scientific, you know, journals and studies to show, for example, that condoms don't work and that abstinence is the only way to prevent STDs. And so And now what they're kind of coming to fruition, where you start seeing people from these groups moved into public health positions in the Bush administration, so that this kind of counterculture is now slowly kind of infiltrating and becoming the establishment.
Yeah, a friend of mine who studies these things says that Ralph Reed has actually read a lot of Gramsci and learned from him. So I guess these guys have been really planning for the long term. But what are the demographics? What percentage of the population do these people represent? What are their, you know, their race, education, income, those sorts of standard demographics?
Sure. Well, I should, because this category that I'm talking about, Christian nationalists, as opposed to Christian fundamentalists or evangelicals, when I talk about Christian nationalists, I mean people who don't just believe in a literal reading of the Bible, but who believe in this whole revisionist history about America being a Christian nation, and who believe in the kind of mass Christianizing of America. So it's a separate category. Evangelicals, somewhere between 30% and 40% of the population. I would say that if you look at, you can look at various polls, you know, for instance, polls of people who.
And evangelicals is important to say, are not just white conservatives, right?
Right. Yes. No. Evangelicals, you know, I mean, they definitely trend conservative, but there are all kinds of evangelicals. And that includes black evangelicals. But if you're talking of then within this category, you have those who, for instance, say that Christian politicians should never compromise with people who have other beliefs, or who favor amending the Constitution to make Christianity explicitly the national religion of the United States. And so kind of extrapolating from different polls, because no one's ever, you know, asked, are you a Christian nationalist, you know, asked all these questions. I would put it somewhere around between 10 and 15% of the population is this group that I'm talking about. There's, you know, I think there's a stereotype out there that they are less educated, and that,
yeah,
and they're
the
just
stereotype
kind of,
is their stakeholders live in the hills, right? But they're not.
Right.
Really.
No, they're not. I mean, they are, you know, by and large, middle class. You know, it's a movement that's kind of very strong in the, I mean, obviously strong in the South, but is also strong in the kind of exurban areas of the West and Midwest, these kind of new, you know, McMansion-type development areas.
Rootless anti-cosmopolitans.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, and I think the rootlessness is really important, because, you know, it's places that have no, I think it has a lot of attractiveness, this kind of infrastructure has a lot of attractiveness in places that have no organic community at all, because, you know, nobody's from there. The communities themselves weren't even there 15 years ago. And there's no public space of any kind. And so you can walk into a megachurch, and besides being given your kind of all-encompassing political ideology, you're also given your whole social world, you know, all in one place. And there's nowhere else to get those things.
Speaking with Michelle Goldberg, who is a writer for Salon and also author of Kingdom Coming, about Christian nationalism in the United States. And that's just out from W.W. Norton. So what are the institutions, the primary institutions that they work their power and influence through?
Well, something that I think is important to understand is that it's become much more diffuse than it used to be. I mean, first, you know, it used to be that there was always a kind of central Washington-based organization, or, you know, Virginia-based, or whatever the case may be. You know, first you had the Moral Majority with Jerry Falwell. Then you had the Christian Coalition. Now you have a series. Now you have a group of kind of interconnected power centers. The Family Research Council is a very important one. Focus on the Family is extremely important. And you have also a number of kind of up-and-coming state-based organizations. There's a pastor named Rick Scarborough in Texas who is very, very close to Tom DeLay, and who is the host of these War on Christians conferences that they've had in Washington.
They do feel very persecuted, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the persecution myth is a kind of fundamental part of the whole ideology. And I've met, you know, actually people who are very, very sweet and, you know, in many ways very kind of amiable, and I have a lot of sympathy for them, and start thinking that maybe we're not that far apart, until they tell me that they believe that Christianity is on the verge of being criminalized, and, you know, kind of believe that they're, you know, just kind of two steps away from some kind of secular totalitarian dystopia.
Well, that's psychotic. That's paranoid psychosis to believe that, isn't it?
Well,
not in a clinical sense. But
I think that Richard Hofstadter described it, you know, best, that these movements kind of, you know, they need to believe that the enemy is so big, they need to believe that the enemy is so enormous, is in many ways equal to their fear and frustration and anger.
Now, to some degree, and you're saying that draws this out, to some degree this is an old trend in American culture. This kind of crazy religious conservatism has been around for a long time. What's different about it this time?
Well, I would say two things. I mean, first of all, there's two different, I think, two different strains of antecedents here. I mean, on the one hand, you have, you know, the Great Awakenings and, you know, different kind of evangelical political movements. I actually think that this movement has more to do with the kind of tradition of, you know, right-wing populism in America that goes back to the nativists and, you know, that saw, you know, upsurges with, you know, Father Coughlin during the Depression and later on with the John Birch Society. This movement dates, has its roots pretty strongly in the John Birch Society. I mean, Tim LaHaye, who is, you know, the author of the Left Behind books, but also a kind of major and important early organizer, one of the founders of the Council for National Policy, got his start as a Birch organizer in California. And a lot of this kind of conspiratorial thinking and this belief that there's these kind of diabolical outside forces that are trying to undermine America from within and comes, you know, straight out of the John Birch Society. It's just that what the Birchers called, it's kind of Birchism with a religious gloss, right? Where the John Birch Society talked about communism, they talk about secular humanism.
But communism was a real thing. There was a Soviet Union, there was an American Communist Party, and you know, there were affiliated things that they could, you know, they could blow these things way out of proportion. But there was a reality base to it. Like, what is the reality base to their paranoia? Is there one?
No, obviously not in the same. Not in the same way. And I think that, I mean, that's part of it. The movement has grown more extreme. Even it's grown both more extreme and more mainstream at the same time. I mean, the big difference between this movement and the John Birch Society was that nobody with any degree of respectability wanted to be associated with the John Birch Society, at least in public. I mean, Barry Goldwater didn't want John Birchers working as volunteers on his campaign because he thought he made, you know, he thought they had this like kind of extremist taint, whereas now these people who have beliefs that are in many ways less rational than the John Birch Society, you know, occupy really important positions throughout the federal bureaucracy,
including the top one. We think,
well, I don't
degree.
Know. I'm kind of ambivalent about.
Yeah, well, we don't.
Really I don't know,
know sure.
the mix of Bush's cynicism and fanaticism is a mystery to me.
Well, that, but, I often thought of the same thought about Pat Robertson. You know, look at that guy on TV and say, "This guy is faking it. This guy is a fraud." What do you think about that?
I'm just not sure. I think maybe he's faking it in terms of his interest in Christian charity. But do I think that he's just a businessman and doesn't have any kind of totalitarian fanaticism? No, I actually think that he does, you know, any more than, you know, somebody can be kind of very venal and also, you know, kind of monomaniacal and believe in their own divinity at the same time.
So, what's their ambition? What's the goal of this Christian nationalist movement?
Well, I should say that for most of them, although not all, it's not some kind of Taliban-style Christian theocracy, although there are people who do advocate that and who do, you know, kind of consort with Republican lawmakers to a degree that should make most people uncomfortable. But for the vast majority of leaders, even, you know, people like James Dobson and the like, what they imagine, they have this revisionist history. They believe that America was founded as a Christian nation, that the founders were conservative Christians.
Which is not true.
Yes, which is not true.
Yes,
but
we have to remind ourselves of that.
As we should mention. But there's this whole library. I mean, and it's just vast and massive with this whole other history. And it's all footnoted to each other. So you can check the references. And it's kind of this impenetrable skein of lies. But so they have this vision of what they think America was. It was just kind of separation of church and state was this lie that was introduced 100 years ago and it's been fostered by these kind of God-hating secularists. And so they believe that we need to return America to this mythical Christian past. And that means that while non-believers or believers in other religions could practice as they please, they would kind of know their place. Christianity would be understood to be both culturally dominant and kind of legally authoritative. I mean, because they believe that the Constitution was inspired by the Bible, which they often say, then they will say that that means that laws that contradict the Bible.
The word God doesn't appear in the Constitution.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. And they've had to reach, I mean, it's interesting because in the past, people, Christian conservatives, you know, kind of closer to the founding of the country, would denounce the Constitution because for its, you know, kind of obvious godlessness. You know, now they can't quite, now this movement can't admit that because they need so desperately to be kind of associated with, you know, patriotism, the founding fathers, and, you know, the kind of symbolism of American nationalism. But no, so the word God doesn't appear in the Constitution, although if you say that to a leader in this movement, they will point out very righteously that it is signed in the year of our Lord, by which they believe which they believe is meant to kind of express, you know, the kind of obvious supremacy of Christian theology in the country's founding.
Not just a linguistic convention, but it's actually a literal meaning. Well, you obviously take this threat quite seriously. You find these people rather scary. What is to be done about them? Do we just there's this movement among some liberals and Democrats who want to talk about values and sort of steal some of their thunder, maybe make some soft appeals. Should we embrace Jim Wallis and Sojourners? What do you think we should do about these folks?
Yeah, I mean, I think people like Jim Wallis have to be a part of it. And I would say that there's a couple different things here. I mean, I think, you know, what Hillary Clinton's doing, which is just, or even, you know, Howard Dean by appearing on Pat Robertson's show, you know, that's kind of disgraceful. And it's also futile. You're not going to get any of the people in this movement. What you might be able to get are some of the kind of people who are attracted to this movement, but not quite converted because they feel like it's speaking to these big existential questions and these big kind of historical questions about, you know, what is this country for? What do we believe in? What are we moving towards? You know, people who feel a little bit unmoored and who feel, you know, kind of alienated and frustrated by, you know, America's kind of crass, you know, vulgar materialism and feel like nobody. So this movement's really speaking to those kind of deeper longings, and the Democrats aren't. So I think that there's an opening for the Democrats to speak to those needs in their own way and, you know, to talk about community and the common good and things like that. People might respond to that. What I don't think Democrats should do is say, oh, yeah, we're just as much against gay marriage as you are, or, you know, we want to ban abortion, too, but just have a few more exceptions.
Well, you identify as a secular urbanite, and you're quite eloquent in saying that that's a position that should be defended. There's this way in which we sort of feel inferior, that they're the real America and we're a bunch of imposters. We've actually internalized that, and you say we shouldn't do that, right?
Well, I mean, there's two things, because on the one hand, I certainly don't want to see the Democratic Party field a candidate who is, you know, kind of proudly from the Lower East Side and talks about, you know, the kind of joys of secular cosmopolitanism. I know that that won't fly. I know that we're a minority. But I also think that, yeah, I mean, the urban population of this country is and the coastal population is, first of all, completely disenfranchised, you know, by our kind of present electoral arrangements. But also, yes, I mean, this kind of whole language of real Americans versus liberal elites, and the language of, you know, when Kerry was running and Bush would say, well, that's what you would expect from a senator from Massachusetts. And nobody thought to say, you know, Massachusetts is actually a state in America that you ostensibly are the president of.
And that Bush himself was born in New Haven, Connecticut. Right?
Yeah, but just the idea that, yes, that you should be ashamed of being from these states that are actually in many ways, not only are they the kind of, were they the core of America when it was founded, where they kind of here from the beginning, but also are in represent the best of America. I mean, and are the most successful states in America, you know, and lead in almost every single kind of social indicator. The idea that kind of Americanism should be equated with kind of bellicose, vulgar ignorance is in itself kind of weirdly anti-American.
Okay. Well, that's a good note to end on. Thanks for joining us, Michelle Goldberg. Michelle Goldberg, a writer for Salon and also author of the book Kingdom Coming, which is just been published by W.W. Norton. Thank you for joining us. Good luck with the book, and I urge folks to pick it up. It's illuminating, scary, but also very well written and entertaining to read. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening, and I'll be back next week with program mostly about music and politics, featuring Ned Sublette, which I'll be recording over the weekend because I won't be around, but it will be on CD. And let's go out with 9 to 5, performed by Ordinary Boys versus Lady Sovereign. Till next week, goodbye.
I wake up late every morning, manager's calling, I'm still yawning. Get up, wake up, hair and makeup's waiting for you, don't be stalling. This performance is important, I don't think I can put my all in.
Oh God, no, was up last night, I was still kicking in and I don't feel right. In my number to a brain, who was on my time? Got my phone on silent, I'm here polite.
Private callers getting no love from me, just let me be. Oh my gosh, my days are getting longer.
Something.